Hello and welcome to the Stinging Fly podcast. My name is Declan Mead and I'm the founding editor of the Stinging Fly and publisher. So the Stinging Fly has been publishing new writers and new writing for the past 25 years. We take a particular interest in promoting the short story, of course, you'll know. And usually on this podcast, we ask a writer to root around an archive and pick out a story to read and discuss with me here. But on this month's episode, I'm joined instead by a poet, and I'm delighted to welcome Anne-Marie Nicurin to the podcast and also to the Stinging Fly as our recently announced new poetry editor. Anne-Marie is a poet from the Donegal Gaeltacht. Her books include Bloodroot, which was published by Dura Press in 2017, and The Poisoned Glen, which was published by the Gallery Press in 2021. She is a recipient of the Arts Council's Next Generation Award and a co-recipient of the Markievicz Award. Anne-Marie has received fellowships and awards from the Jack Kerouac House in Florida, the Centre Culturel Irlandais in Paris, and the Akademie Schloss Solitude in Germany. She was the 2022-2023 Decades of Centenaries Poet in Residence at Donegal Archive Service, where she researched the stories of mothers and children in the Stranalar Workhouse and the Stranalar County Home. She currently lives between Dublin and Donegal and is an active member of the Writers in Prison scheme in Ireland. Anne-Marie was first published in The Stinging Fly back in 2008 in issue 11, volume 2, with her poem The Scandal, which you'll read for us later on in our talk today. And she was also featured poet in our summer 2017 issue. So hello, Anne-Marie, and welcome to the podcast and welcome to The Stinging Fly.
Hello, Declan. It's really nice to be here with you.
Great. So as I kind of was saying there during my introduction, usually on the podcast we have somebody read from a story in the archive, but you're going to read a couple of poems, first of all, from recent issues of the magazine. So I'll leave you to introduce those two poems now, if you would, and read them for us, please.
I had lots of fun looking through the archives, and I was particularly drawn to a poem by Paula Meehan in issue 46, which is titled Natal Horoscope. When I go and get the time of my birth from the nurse's log in the rotunda, 25th of June 1955, 6:40 of a midsummer's morning, I imagine my mother in her throes, her last hard push, my first deep breath by earth offered. I bow to her in gratitude. Bless the ground that sustains me, longitude, latitude, the whole planet become hearth. Its sparks mirroring the stars, my joys, woes, my patterns already mapped. This small song snatched from the sunny afternoon, the hive of the cosmos buzzing, I meander along the fated, well-worn ancient path. That was such a pleasure to read, and I always find with Paula's work that there's so much musicality inbuilt into the poems that they're kind of like songs to deliver into space. But there's so many things I love about this poem, Declan. Yeah. I mean, I've been reading Paula's work for such a long time. I mean, she's one of our best known poets. And I think that one of the reasons that we connect with her poetry so intimately is because her work carries this almost mystical, magnetic charge. This poem, like so many other poems in her body of work, seems kind of touched by a bit of magic. And at first glance, when I was looking through the archives, the title caught my attention. You know, Natal Horoscope is a title in which I can imagine my own experience, because we all have a horoscope. And yeah. And that is so typical of the generosity in Paula's work.
Yeah.
But also the poem at a first glance, you know, when I encountered it, it's in two clean halves, two stanzas. each of 7 lines. So even at first touch, that form or that shape says to me that this is going to be a poem about balance or equilibrium, or maybe going to speak to the idea of harmony. So even before I get into reading the poem, from the outset, it's carrying all of that electricity.
And I mean, she calls it herself a small song in the poem itself, you know, like that reference to it. But and then you're going to read another poem for us from our All New Writers issue, which was published last November. That's by Chandrika.
Chandrika Narayanan Mohan is a writer from India who is now living in Dublin. And when I came across this poem, I recognized the dedication in the dedication that this poem is a response to a poem by Jane Hirshfield. So the title of the poem is The Knee. It comes from issue
47.
And it's dedicated to Jane Hirshfield, who has a poem titled A Hand. And Jane's poem begins with the line, "A hand is not 4 fingers and a thumb." So just bear that in mind, maybe, as we kind of read through the poem. The knee. The knee is not a city of hollow cathedrals and patella gates, of stitched ligament and stretched tendon, and the empty agora, where the blood once gathered, then evacuated. It is not the Velcro crunch of itself as it bends and carries, the ache and the strain, the burden of movement. It is not even the nudge into the crook of your bent leg, the puzzle piece of it where it whispers to your tendons in the night. It is not a rock face, pockmarked, water-carved, allowing itself to be hollowed and lived in and river-rushed. Only in rest is it a mountain range, both busy and silent under a dark sky, allowing safe passage through a burdenless night.
Very good. So what attracts you to a poem like this?
Well, first of all, I think it's a very accomplished response to Jane Hirshfield's poem, because it, you know, borrows from Jane's first line, and it borrows from this idea of starting a poem with a definition of what a thing is not, which I think is a really interesting place to start, because when we start with a definition of what a thing is not, we open up room for discovery and journey and realization. And this poem is really a poem about journey. There's a lot of movement in the text. The language seems to kind of dance with itself. And we see that in words like pockmarked, water carved, river rushed. You know, the language seems to trip and swing and latch and swerve forward, so that we're really gathering the impression of toll, and the toll that a journey can take, the weight that the body can take, and the kind of forward momentum of living. And I suppose that as this poem unfolds, I expect at the end of the poem to come to a definition of what the knee is. But it doesn't. The poem comes to a place of rest. And in the last lines, there's a beautiful paradox there. You know, the knee is rendered as a mountain range, which is both busy and silent under a dark sky. And I think that's a lovely ending, because it's a kind of conflict of sorts. You know, the mountain is both at rest, but it's both busy. And that's kind of life, and that's our imaginations, and that's how poetry works.
As a reader of poetry, I mean, what do you go looking for in poetry, or what do you hope to find in poetry?
I suppose I always want to find a voice that is completely itself. And I'm excited about poems that could only have been written by the poet who wrote them. And I think in some ways it's not hard to make a poem function, to make it stand up, to make it technically right. But where the skill and craft really comes in is in rendering a mystery in a poem. You know, Jane Hirschfield has this lovely saying. She says, as life is not a gate, but the horse plunging through it. And in many ways, I think the same can be said of a poem. You know, a poem can work as a technical thing in language, but it's that horse plunging through it that excites my imagination. You know, that little kind of flicker of the unknown or the unexpected. So I'm always looking for poetry with that fresh energy that brings together skill and craft, imagination and mystery.
Right. And who would be, the poets or the poems that have given you, kind of have fed you, I suppose, in your kind of development as a poet yourself?
Well, I think my first entry into poetry was through the oral tradition, because I grew up in rural Donegal and I grew up in the Gaeltacht. So I had really wonderful exposure to folklore, storytelling, mythology, ritual, superstition, all of that richness, you know. But my first kind of engagements with languages, play and the craft of language was through, you know, the stories that my mother's knitting group would tell, or the kind of rhymes that we would say on the bog to pass the time. You know, that was kind of the first experience of poetic language. And then, of course, when I became a teenager, I fell in love with the poets that were available to me, and who I'm still very fond of. And that would have been the poetry of Derek Mahan, Newell and Ionel, later Kavanagh, later Evan Boland. So that kind of, you know, gave me a good solid foundation, reading foundation. But now I read much more diversely, you know, and I try to read in translation as much as possible. And right now at this moment, I think the poets that excite me are the indigenous voices coming out of the US, you know, poets like Natalie Diaz, Lily Long Soldier. I think that, you know, they're really interesting in that they're bearing witness not only to social injustice, but also to what's happening in terms of climate crisis, you know. So they're occupying a really important space at the moment. So that's kind of my current obsession. But, you know, I go through kind of shifts, and next month it'll be another new obsession. So I try to read as widely as possible.
Yeah. Although it's interesting that you use the phrase bearing witness there when you're talking about these poets that you currently admire and are following their work, because I had just written down witness poems in relation to your own work. It's something that really strikes me as being really important to your work. Mm-hmm. And so do you want to talk about that? Because I suppose, because everyone will have different sense of what the poem is and what the poem can do. Mm-hmm. And my feeling in your poetry is that you believe in providing witness.
Yeah, I think that's true. Like, I believe in the transformative nature of the poem, as in, you know, language as a place where we can imagine or dream or look to other realities, you know. And I'd be very influenced by poets like Audre Lorde, you know, who had a social activism side to their practice. And Audre Lorde says poetry is not a luxury.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of, you know, that kind of idea that I hold, that poetry can be of some kind of practical use as well as a kind of a mystical thing, it does go back to my earliest engagements with language. You know, I kind of mentioned that, you know, the rhymes that we told on the bog, or the fisherman stories, or the islander stories that were told to me in Donegal. You know, all of those all of that language was rooted in community, and it was often kind of rooted in the real circumstances of people's lives, and happened kind of you know, in a kind of collective environment as well. So that today my own practice is often rooted in community, and I'm interested in kind of bearing witness to community stories as well. So it's, I suppose I can draw almost a direct thread from what my practice looks like today and my interest in bearing witness and where I come from as well.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe we'll get you to read the poems then that you brought along today, that you had published in The Stinging Fly, and the first one being The Scandal from back in 2008. Oops. Or is it, if that's okay, whichever one you want to read yourself. But yeah.
Yeah, it was really exciting to kind of take out this issue of The Stinging Fly from 2008. And this was my first properly published poem. I say properly because my actual first poem was published on the back page of The Messenger, which was a little Catholic pamphlet in the 1980s.
Very good, yes. Yeah.
But this was my first properly published poem. And when I got the poem, when I got the journal, like, I couldn't stop sniffing it and stroking it and just flicking through all the pages. It's really well worn. So this is The Scandal. The villagers did not unite in outrage, but instead they set about their days as usual, posting letters, buying fruit, forming queues in the bank after lunchtime. They said little, but within that little lay much. Little was a gated field in which something extraordinary was buried. They held to their inner selves, resilient in emergencies of projected light. And yet, over time, there happened a slow retreat from joyousness, a packing away of the emperor's new clothes for good. Only the giant oaks would live to remember imagination.
Thank you very much, Anne-Marie. Can you remember the writing of that poem? Or?
I think that I was doing a master's in creative writing at the Oscar Wilde Centre in Trinity. And it was a year-long kind of process of discovery, and it kind of, you know, it got me away from writing these kind of slightly shallow, one-dimensional love poems, and it brought me into a more kind of rooted space, you know. And this is one of the poems that has survived from that master's manuscript, and which made it into my debut collection. But there was only one or two poems from that time that went into my first collection.
Very good. And so I'll just get you to read the next poem then as well, which is The Wall from issue 36, volume 2, summer 2017.
So this poem was written around 2016, when I was listening to the language of the US elections. And I was thinking about this image of the wall and trying to meditate on what that image has meant in my own life. The poem begins with a preface, short quote from Rosario Castellanos, who says, "Between all of them, they raise little by little a wall that will keep out the thing that lies waiting for the tiniest crack of silence to steal through. Wall. First, a wall that contracts me out of my unfurled state. Next, one that divides me from my own kin. It is the same wall I am sitting on when Green, aged 9, is pulled from the schoolyard for yelling, "Dicks and fannies are what make babies." I thought I could fly, I said, when asked why I'd hurled myself forward, arms outspread and eyes closed tight to the world. There are the wall boys who want in under your bra with their cold fingers, and the wall girls who will teach you how to leave a bite. There is the wall that goes up inside you the first time you're called a slut. There is the wall of grinning wet-lipped farmers that gathers around the teenage girls at the local beauty pageant show as you in a borrowed dress are herded into the ring. Writer, wrong answer, and you lose to the sergeant's daughter. It should have been you, the barman sighs, as he swipes the taps with a dirty cloth. That could have been me, but instead I am scored out of 10 and told to try again next year. I am 16 by the time a fire in my chest begins to burn from the inside out. I am 17 when I learn how to starve myself. I am 18 the summer I join my brothers in the building trade, laying concrete, smoothing lines of dark wet cement. I am standing on the site early one morning with the hot sun in my eyes and a brick in my hand when a man dares to ask me, "What do you know about walls?"
Thank you very much, Anne-Marie. So that takes the form, I suppose, of a prose poem. I mean, and in terms of, and you mentioned the look of Paula Meehan's poem on the page earlier as well. I mean, when are decisions made about that type, the structure of a poem? When do decisions like that get made for you?
Well, I might be thinking of the structure of a poem from the outset and, you know, trying to identify an image in the poem or a visual that or a theme that might instruct the form. But sometimes the form will come at the very end as well. And I mean, I was wrestling with this poem wall for a very long time. And it came to me kind of at some point through that wrestle that actually by thinking about form and thinking about a restraint, that was actually going to open up the poem and kind of help me along. And it seems like such an obvious thing now, but when I started to put the wall poem into the shape of a wall, everything began to fall into place, you know. So these things can just seem so obvious, you know, at the end of the process. And I'm sure now it seems daft that I, you know, at one point never had this poem in the shape of a wall, but it kind of took a minute, you know, to find my way into that.
Yeah. How has your writing of poems developed over time, and how has that the process changed for you? Or has it changed much?
I think every poem is like starting all over again. You know, it really is, for better and for worse, because you just think, God, can I do it again? You know, and every poem is starting in this place of total uncertainty. I mean, I really try to stick to a process where I write and I write until I kind of dislocate something in myself. You know, I either write something that is embarrassing or write something that makes me vulnerable or write something that shocks me or surprises me. But that is the measure for me of when I am into a poem. And then once you're into a poem, it can still take a long time to find the form and to realize it. But that kind of, you know, cracking open of a poem, there's almost no easy way into that except just keep writing and writing and writing.
Right, yeah. And then because you've had the experience of publishing 2 books and gone through that process, do you now view a poem that you write as necessarily being part of the next book, mm-hmm. or can it be separate to that? Or
it's, you know, it depends. I mean, at the moment, I am just putting the finishing touches to a pamphlet, which is a commission from the Donegal Archives to respond to one of the workhouses in Donegal, which was eventually kind of turned into a home for unmarried mothers. So in a way, you know, the brief is quite specific. So the challenge for me there is to try and go in and find room within that brief to be kind of free and adventurous and playful. So with a project like that, you know, of course, I know that whatever I'm writing is likely to go into the pamphlet. However, I have to leave myself the wiggle room that I may write stuff that doesn't fit, that I may write stuff that is just not going to be part of the puzzle of that pamphlet, you know. I suppose in the main kind of like throes of my writing day to day, I do try to remain free, because I think if you kind of box yourself into the idea of a collection too soon, it can become very rigid. There's a risk that it might become a little bit stale. So, you know, you're all the time writing. But listen, you know, with a book like The Poison Glen or Bloodroot, I had almost twice the amount of poems. You know, only half of the poems I had went into the collection. Yeah. So it's a great thing about having lots of material then, that you do have that freedom from the outset. Yeah.
And in gathering that material towards what might be the third book, I mean, what is your process of like writing in terms of time spent, mm-hmm. Actually writing? Or
I will try and take notes every day, right. And I'm definitely at my computer every day. Now, there is like some days and I'm sitting at the laptop and I'm doing more reading than writing, and sometimes I'm just writing down doodles, you know, and they can be so cryptic when I look back over them that I possibly don't know what they mean 3 weeks later. But I try to exercise that muscle every day. But then, you know, it's a challenge to get long periods of sustained writing time. I mean, we all have commitments. We all have busy lives. So, you know, I make it my business to take myself away for, you know, like every couple of weeks to block off like a week, you know, yeah. every week, every month, you know, to try and block off, or every 6 weeks. And for periods like that, like I might go back to Donegal, stay in a little remote cottage, or I might go to Anna McCarrick, or I might just put the phone off the hook and stay at home and like put on my out of office and I'm not there. So it's a bit like that. It's like taking notes every day and then blocking off time.
And if you've got a week, let's say, in Donegal or in Anna McCarrick, what is the hope that you might, would you have an ideal number of poems that you've tried to write in that time? Or
I mean, I don't know if this is this is probably not how every poet works, but I love to have a plan, you know, right, yeah. as in a work plan. Yeah. I mean, I can't plan for the poems. I can't plan for what I'm going to write, but I love making lists. I love, like, you know, this is what I'm going to concentrate. And then I always think, you know, if I go to Anna McCarrick, I have my plan for the week and I deviate from it, that's fine. That's natural, you know, but I guess time is so limited and you want to make the most of it, and you want to, you know, feel that, you know, you're using it properly. I mean, the other part of my process that is quite important, or has become quite important, is going for runs. Right. And, you know, that kind of goes hand in hand. The experience of kind of being outside, being around the natural world, being kind of out of a domestic space, is like almost goes hand in hand with reading, you know. Yeah. And it's like this kind of constellation of three very important things that need to happen for writing. You know, there needs to be the actual writing, and MacBook open, there needs to be my running gear and a good place to kind of go running, and there needs to be plenty of reading material. And then once all of those things are moved into place for a week, then you just hope the magic happens.
Yeah. I think I heard you say at some point, I think it was after the first collection, Blood Root, had come out, where you were talking about placing yourself in the landscape, mm-hmm. and that was important to you at that time anyway.
Yeah, very important. Very important. I would say that, like, I would say nearly all of my poems are written on a site, like the early drafts. And what happens at the desk is editing, or is, you know, moving text around and kind of developing it. But the first drafts, like, they would happen usually outside, you know, like visiting a site or being somewhere that has particular historical resonance, or even just sitting on a bench. Or I just find it really difficult to get that first kind of draft if I'm sitting at a desk in a domestic space. You know, yeah. I'm a bit like a mountain goat. Like, I need to go out to be at one. It goes back to how I first learned to engage with language. Yeah. You know, it was kind of a more I don't know. It was a freer environment that I was in. It wasn't sitting in the box room, under the lamp with the MacBook.
A lot of the poems, certainly in The Poisoned Glen, kind of are, and the pamphlet you've just been talking about as well, kind of are on the issue of institutions and what happened in those institutions, and I suppose I'll use the word victims of those places, the people who went through, had those experiences. Could you talk a little bit about that and your engagement with?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, as I was preparing for this session, I was thinking about my first published poem, the little poem in the back of the Catholic Messenger, and the theme of the title on that poem was foster child. So it's just amazing to me that kind of subject matter, the child who is separated from family and the child who goes through different systems and institutions, that kind of, you know, inclination to explore that subject matter was there from such a young age. But I suppose it's a story that I'm always working through. My own father was born in a mother and baby home. My own paternal side of the family were split kind of north and south when I was growing up. And then my own family fostered children. So I've always been around this kind of, you know, fractured family story. And I've come at that subject matter in different ways. I mean, in Bloodroot, there are poems there that kind of draw from Irish history and from the lives of women and children in Ireland over the last 100 years under the influence of church and state. But then in The Poisoned Glen, I come at that subject matter through mythology. So coming at it in a more imaginative way and drawing upon folklore and pre-Christian landscapes. So in a way, the two books are kind of companion books that sit side by side and speak to each other.
Sure. I want to talk now a little bit about you've taken on the role of Sting and Fly editor, poetry editor. So that's upcoming. But recently you edited the Stony Thursday book last year, and you've just edited the summer edition of Poetry Ireland Review. So I suppose to get a sense of your experiences of editing those two publications and what you're looking forward to when you're moving towards editing becoming the next poetry editor of the Sting and Fly.
Well, it's been such a lovely discovery for me to realize that I just absolutely love being in an editorial role. I really love the process of making poetry selections and bringing poetry, poems together in conversation with each other. And I love the conversations with poets as well. And it's something that I never realized when I first started sending out work that, you know, sometimes I'm speaking personally here, but on the other end of that submissions process is an editor who is really rooting for you. You know, I just love reading every new poem that comes in. And even if there's three poems in a submission and the first one, you know, I'm not, you know, there's nothing in it that strikes me, I'm on in kind of a hungry capacity to the second one. And if there's nothing there, I'm on in a hungry capacity to the third one. You know, I'm hoping with every poem that this is the one that is going to light up the page and that is going to kind of move me. So I think what I learned from editing Stony Thursday and Poetry Ireland Review is that now is kind of an exciting time for poetry in Ireland.
Yeah.
You know, there really is a refreshed excitement around poetry, and that has got to be something to do with the new diversity of voices as well. You know, there's a new excitement about language and different types of languages and different styles and approaches, and I'm like counting down the sleeps till I can start reading the Stinging Fly submissions.
Well, the time will come. I think our next submission period is in November, and after that you'll have more than plenty of poems to read. I'm quite sure of that. So with those two other publications, I mean, what would you say is the thing that surprised you most about the process, or what did you discover?
Oh, you know what surprised me, and I don't know really what to make of this yet, but sometimes when I had a submission from a poet and I had a good feeling about their work, but I really didn't want to publish the work that they sent me, I would go back to that poet and ask them if they had any other work. And almost 9 times out of 10, the new work that the poet sent me would be the work that I wanted. And I was thinking about that in the context of the way that I send out my work myself. You know, we can often sometimes hold back the material that we're really close to, or that we want to, that we're afraid to let go of. And sometimes we can get the submissions wrong, you know, and not send out our best work.
Yeah.
I was just so surprised by the number of poets who came back when I sent them a request, sent me a second submission, and the second submission was the poem I needed.
I think it happens particularly with poetry. I mean, I've definitely heard poets say that things like, well, they wouldn't, you know, magazine editors wouldn't want this poem or this type of poem. And they have, but they've decided that for themselves and they rule them, you know, and so we don't sometimes get to see those poems, which is such a shame.
Fascinating, yeah.
What is your understanding then of the role of the editor, let's say, of the Stinging Fly?
Oh, that's really difficult to...
It's like a job interview, Albert. But you've already got the job.
That's difficult to know now until I'm kind of... I think my job at the moment is to find the best new poetry out there, and to bring it together. And, you know, there'll be other aspects to that role that kind of develop over time. I mean, I would love to have a role, supporting poets where I can, and, you know, having conversations with them and encouraging them. And I'm really interested in, you know, emerging voices, but also new voices, and in the voices of older poets as well, you know, and making sure that they're included. So that'll be a fun side to it as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I noticed in your, in the Poison Glen, there's in your acknowledgements, you mentioned a few a few writers that I know, like Evelyn Collin and Jerry Smith, and who was the third writer?
Thomas McCarthy,
of course.
they're my poetry. They're my literary angels.
Yeah, but I
my
mean,
godparents.
And then you just when you mentioned that, you know, it's important to have the older voices included in the mix as well, which I think is so true, because very recently I was talking to a young poet who had come across Maurice Scully's work in The Stinging Fly, and poor Maurice obviously died this year, but this younger poet wouldn't have known Maurice's work unless he'd read it in The Stinging Fly, and then had gone off and read, you know, and bought several of Maurice's books and was just a complete fan, you know. So that's why it's important to include the older poets, I think, as well. But also, like, in terms of your dialogue with writers of an older generation, how important is that? Has that been for you?
Hugely important. I mean, the first workshops that I went to as a teenager in the Poets' House in Donegal, I was just in awe of the older writers who came to Donegal, Leland Bardwell, Jimmy Simmons, Maeve McGuckian. And this was, you know, kind of pre having access to online reading material. And also there wasn't a local library in where I was in Donegal. So these poets would come, and they would come with their printouts, you know, and you'd take that page with a poem and really kind of cherish it and maybe photocopy it for other people. So it was a real kind of human experience, and I just remain very conscious that like writing is this long life, and poetry is this long, marvelous, frustrating, exciting game. But like, we can really learn from people who've been through that process, who've been on that journey. And writers like, you know, Thomas McCarthy have taught me so much about cultivating a spirit of optimism, of being generous with your poetry community, of looking to the future, of, you know, he's just taught me so much, so many useful skills that are going to last me a lifetime. And, you know, we are in our, because we spend so much time now, there is that risk and that danger that you're going to start, you know, be reading more of your peers than, you know, that you can, I suppose, that you can become boxed in your reading habits. Yeah. And, you know, it's important to read widely and, yeah, learn from older poets for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And I want to ask you about your idea of who the audience is for poetry, or who do you imagine the audience for poetry to be? And at what point do you, like, how important is that in your thinking of about poetry?
Yeah, I mean, recently a journalist asked me, you know, did I see the poet being at a remove from society? You know, and there can be that idea of, you know, the poet in the attic waiting for the muse, kind of, you know, working remotely in a detached fashion. But like, for me, my own practice is very grounded in community, and it was kind of interwoven into the fabric of everyday life. So, you know, my siblings are not involved in the arts, but and they're, you know, my brothers are all tradespeople, but they'd all have an appreciation of the craft of a poem, and that a poem is a made thing, that a poem is takes raw material, it transforms it, and, you know, it makes something out of nothing. So, you know, I think the audience for poetry can be anyone. And like, because I have had that background exposure to oral storytelling, I'm familiar with the idea of a poem that lives in spaces outside bookshops, outside libraries, outside books, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think, you know, poetry has a place all across society. I mean, in my own work as a poet. I have worked in prisons and hospitals and healthcare centres and, you know, you name it, I've probably had a gig as a poet there.
Yeah, and that, obviously, that contact, I suppose, helps inform your work and shape your work as well and make it what it is, or help, you know. It sounds to me like you're optimistic about of what poetry is right now in Ireland and what it can be. And
yeah, absolutely. I mean, I just can't see us ever not being interested in playing with words. I mean, I just don't even know what that reality would look like. And, you know, it's the same with printed literature. I mean, we're always going to want to see what our mark looks like on the page. We're always going to want to feel a page, you know, and we're always going to want to make sounds with our bodies into space so that people can enjoy them. So, I mean, there's just no doubt in my mind that, like, poetry is as important as, you know, it's just part of life, part of living. It's but also, as I said, now is a particularly exciting time because, like, the canon of literature is being opened up, you know, and it's being reimagined. And it's so exciting to me to have a workshop where you have poets who are working out of different traditions and who are working with different languages. And that's good for everyone. It just wakes us all up and keeps us alert to the possibilities of language.
Of course, I should mention at least that you've been teaching on our summer school for the past couple of years. And so, I mean, has teaching poetry become a big part of your practice as well?
I get such a buzz off being around people who are having that early experience of putting language onto a page and editing it. You know, I get a real buzz of working, for example, in the prisons where sometimes people are, you know, transforming their experience through language for the very first time. I would say that workshops and teaching, the Stinging Fly Summer School is particularly special, you know, and that's a highlight of the year because the people who are coming to that school are very well read, very focused, and very open to the process of feedback and critical thinking and being with each other to progress the poetry, you know. So that is different to, you know, a festival workshop where people might be coming for more of a social time.
Yeah.
That kind of nourishes me as well. I mean, I always find the Stinging Fly Summer School so inspiring, you know, and you're exhausted because you're teaching, but you're kind of rushing home to try and write down your own notes as well, you know. So that's always a good sign when something feeds your own practice.
Yeah. And that is a big question that a lot of people in the arts are grappling with. But how do we try to increase access or improve access to the arts for people? From your experience, what can be done? Or what, you know, and I think it's about doing a lot of little things or a lot more little things, maybe. I don't know.
I don't have any kind of coherent, really kind of sophisticated answers, but I do think that, it's important to ensure that, you know, I'm going to speak for poetry spaces in particular, that, you know, they continue to evolve and change and welcome people in. Because, I think we've come out of a place where poetry was very dominated by one particular type of voice. And, I'm such an admirer of the canon of literature in Ireland and of the voices that came before. And I enjoy, you know, a tradition that is rooted. But I also think that, you know, now is a time of shifts and changes. And it's incumbent upon us all to remember that, you know, if we just start with the idea that there's been one language in Ireland, you know, really well served in poetry over other languages. But, you know, we also have the Irish language. We also have a traveller language. We also have sign language. We have Ulster Scots. And that's even before we begin with all of the new languages.
Yeah.
And how exciting to think now that, you know, we can enjoy all of those things and the meld and the energy and how all those things bounce and rub off each other. So, I can't speak for, you know, the arts as a sector, but I can only speak for poetry that we really need to keep our, you know, an eye open for the ways that we can really truly be inclusive and diverse. And I don't mean in the box ticking exercise, but how can we revel in that, you know, in diversity?
Yeah, and it's a real opportunity, I think, and for us. So Anne-Marie, I'm going to say thank you very much for joining us for the podcast today. We've run out of time. Everyone, if you've enjoyed this episode, please share it. And if you're new to the podcast, please subscribe. Nicole Flattery will be back next month with another writer reading a story from the Sting and Fly archive. Access to the Sting and Fly's full archive is available to everyone who subscribes to the magazine and to our patrons. Taking out a subscription is a great way to support what we do. Subscribe at stingingfly.org. We want to thank the Arts Council who provide funding for this podcast and for everything else that the Sting and Fly is doing to seek out, nurture, publish and promote the very best new writers and new writing. Thank you all for listening. Thanks to Anne-Marie for joining me. Until next time.